We're starting chapter 30 of Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, called Grop. I don't like this part of the story.
It's only because you don't like Hagrid.
You know, it is because I don't like Hagrid.
But Hagrid is adorable.
Yeah, adorable schmadorable.
No, come on. He's a good person.
He is a good person. I'll grant you that. You should have told someone about Grop, though.
Yeah, probably.
I mean, his track record for
him. Well, I mean, people know about him, apparently.
Yeah, well.
With the forest people.
Yeah, the forest people know, of course. The story of Fred and George's flight to freedom was retold so often over the next few days that Harry could tell it would soon become the stuff of Hogwarts legend. Within a week, even those who had been eyewitnesses were half convinced that they'd seen the twins dive bomb Umbridge on their brooms, pelting her with dung bomb before zooming out of the doors.
They should have done that.
In the immediate aftermath of their departure, there was a great wave of talk about copying them, so Harry frequently heard students saying things like, "Honestly, some days I just feel like jumping on my broom and leaving this place. Or else, one more lesson like that, and I might just do a Weasley." It would be pull a Weasley.
Yeah.
You know. Fred and George.
Do a Weasley.
Do a Weasley, I know, right?
We didn't.
Yeah, that's what Harry wants to do. Yeah. Harry would do a Weasley.
Not yet.
Not yet. Eventually. Is she too young?
He's not interested yet.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Yes.
No, wait. She's what, a year younger than them?
Yeah.
And he's 15.
Yeah.
So she's 14.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you really want your kids to be having sex at that age?
No, I don't. But, like, in some cultures, it's perfectly... Like, they'd be married by now.
Yeah, are we really gonna, like, support the cookie? Really? We're gonna push for that?
Fred and George had made sure that nobody was likely to forget them very soon. For one thing, they had not left instructions on how to remove the swamp until it now filled the corridor on the fifth floor of the East Wing. Umbridge and Filch had been observed trying different means of removing it, but without success. Eventually, the area was roped off, and Filch, gnashing his teeth furiously, was given the task of punting students across to their classrooms. Harry was certain that teachers like McGonagall or Flitwick could have removed the swamp in an instant, but just as in the case of Fred and George's wildfire whizbangs, they seemed to prefer to watch Umbridge struggle. Then,
wait, he had to punt his kids across, like kick them?
I guess. I don't think she means kick. I'm guessing it means, like, carry them across. You know? I'll bet it's, like, a Britishism.
Okay.
Because she... What is he going to do? Kicking their butts, you know?
No, but I mean...
He would enjoy that.
Yeah. But the other thing is, he can't carry them. He's, like, a weak little thing.
Yeah. Oh, maybe a punt is... Is a punt, like, a little rowboat or something? I think that's it. Let me look this up real quick.
Okay.
Punt. Punt is a boat. A punt is a flat-bottom boat with a square-cut bow designed for use in small rivers or other shallow water.
There you go.
Punting refers to boating in a punt.
Perfect.
The punter generally propels the boat by pushing against the river with a pole. A punt should not be confused with a gondola, which is propelled by an oar rather than a pole. There you go. That's what she means. You learn something every day.
Exactly. See, who said you didn't learn anything from J.K. Rowling?
I know. I think I said that. Then there were the two large broom-shaped holes in Umbridge's office door, through which Fred and George's clean sweeps had smashed to rejoin their masters. Filch fitted a new door and removed Harry's firebolt to the dungeons, where it was rumored Umbridge had sent an armored security troll to guard it. However, her troubles were far from over. Inspired by Fred and George's example, a great number of students were now vying for the newly vacant position of troublemakers-in-chief. In spite of the new door, somebody managed to slip a hairy-snouted Niffler into Umbridge's office, which promptly tore the place apart in search for shiny objects, leapt on Umbridge in her entrance, upon her re-entrance, and tried to gnaw the rings off her stubby fingers. Dung bombs and stink pellets were dropped so frequently in the corridors that it became the new fashion for students to perform bubblehead charms on themselves before leaving lessons, for it ensured a supply of fresh, clean air, even though it gave them all the peculiar appearance of wearing upside-down goldfish bowls on their heads. Filch prowled the corridors with a horsewhip ready in his hands, desperate to catch miscreants But the problem was that there were so many of them now, he didn't know which way to turn. The Inquisitorial Squad were attempting to help him, but odd things kept happening to its members. Warrington of the Slytherin Quidditch team reported to the hospital wing with a horrible skin complaint that made him look as though he'd been coated in cornflakes. Pansy Parkinson, to Hermione's delight, missed all of her lessons the following day, as she had sprouted antlers. Meanwhile, it became clear just how many skiving snack boxes Fred and George had managed to sell before leaving Hogwarts. Umbridge had only to enter her classroom for the students assembled there to faint, vomit, develop dangerous fevers, or else sprout blood from both nostrils. Shrieking with rage and frustration, she attempted to trace the mysterious symptoms to their source. The students told her stubbornly they were suffering from umbragitis. After putting four successive classes in detention and failing to discover their secret, she forced to give up and allow the bleeding, swooning, sweating, and vomiting students to leave her classes in droves. But not even the users of the snack boxes could compete with that master of chaos, Peeves, who seemed to have taken Fred's parting words to heart. Excuse me. Cackling madly, he soared through the school, upending tables, bursting out of the blackboards, toppling statues and vases. Twice, he shut Mrs. Norris inside suits of armor, from which she was rescued, yowling loudly by the furious caretaker. He smashed lanterns and snuffed out candles, juggled burning torches over the heads of screaming students, caused neatly stacked piles of parchment to topple into fires or out of windows, flooded the second floor when he pulled out all the taps of the bathrooms, dropped a bag of tarantulas in the middle of the great hall during breakfast, and, whenever he fancied a break, spent hours at a time floating along after Umbridge and blowing loud raspberries every time she spoke. None of the staff but Filch seemed to be stirred themselves to help her. Indeed, after a week after Fred George's departure, Harry witnessed Professor McGonagall walking right past Peeves, who was determinedly loosening a crystal chandelier, and could have sworn he heard it tell the poltergeist out of the corner of her mouth, "It unscrews the other way." To cap matters, Montague had still not recovered Montague had still not recovered from his sojourn to the toilet. He remained confused and disoriented, and his parents were observed one Tuesday morning, striding up to the front door, looking extremely angry. "Should we say something?" said Hermione in a worried voice, pressing her cheek against the charms window so that she could see Mr. and Mrs. Montague inside. "About what happened to him? And help, in case it helps Madame Pomfrey to cure him? Wait, what happened to Montague?"
"Fred and George shoved him in the vanishing cabinet that will later be significant, remember?"
"Wait, I don't remember."
"Don't worry about it."
"Of course not, he'll recover," said Fred, said Ron, indifferently. "Anyway, more trouble for Umbridge, isn't it?" said Harry in a satisfied voice. He and Ron both tapped teacups that were supposed to be charming with their wands. Harry's sprouted four very short legs that would not reach the desk, but wriggled pointlessly in midair. Ron's grew four very thin, spindly legs that hoisted the cup off the desk with great difficulty, trembled for a few seconds, then folded, causing the cup to crack in two. "Reparo," said Hermione quickly, mending Ron's cup with a wave of her hand. "That's all very well, but what if Montague's permanently injured?" "Who cares?" said Ron irritably, while his teacup stood drunkenly again, trembling violently at the knees. "Montague shouldn't have tried to take those points from Gryffindor, should he? If you want to worry about anyone, Hermione, worry about me." "You," she said, catching her teacup, as it scampered happily away across the desk on four sturdy little willow-patterned legs and replacing it in front of her. "Why should I be worried about you?" "When Mum's next letter finally gets through Umbridge's screening process," Ron said bitterly, now holding his cup up, while its frail legs tried feebly to support its weight. "I'm going to be in deep trouble. I wouldn't be surprised if she sent a howler again." "But it'll be my fault Fred and George left. You wait," said Ron darkly. "She'll say I should have stopped them from leaving. I should have grabbed the ends of their brooms and hung on or something. Yeah, it'll all be my fault." "Well, if she does say that, it'll be very unfair. You couldn't have done anything." "I'm sure she won't. I mean, if it's really true they've got premises in Diagon Alley now, they must have been planning this for ages." "Yeah, but that's another thing. How did they get premises?" said Ron, hitting his teacup so hard at his wand, with his wand that its legs collapsed again and it lay twitching before him. It's a bit dodgy, isn't it? They'll need loads of galleons to afford the rent in a place in Diagon Alley. She'll want to know what they've been up to get their hands on that sort of gold. Yes, that occurred to me too, said Hermione, allowing her teacup to jog in neat little circles around Harry's, whose stubby little legs were still unable to touch the desk top. I've been wondering whether Mundungus has persuaded them to sell stolen goods or something awful. He hasn't, said Harry curtly. How do you know, said Ron and Hermione together. Because, Harry hesitated, but the moment had to confess finally seemed to have come. There was no good to be gained in keeping it silent if it meant anyone suspected Fred and George were criminals. Because they got the gold from me. I gave them my Triwizard winnings last year. There was a shocked silence, and Hermione's teacup jogged right over the edge of the desk and smashed on the floor. Oh, Harry, you didn't, she said. Yes, I did, said Harry mutinously, and I don't regret it either. I didn't need the gold, and they'll be great at a joke shop. This is excellent, said Ron, looking thrilled. It's all your fault, Harry. Mom can't blame me at all. Can I tell her? Yeah, I suppose you'd better, said Harry dully, especially if she thinks they're receiving stolen cauldrons or something. Hermione said nothing for the rest of the lesson, but Harry had a shrewd suspicion that her self-restraint was bound to crack before long. Sure enough, once they had left the castle for break and they were standing in the weak May sunshine, she fixed Harry with a beady eye and opened her mouth with a determined air. Harry interrupted her before she had even started. It's no good nagging me. It's done, he said firmly. Fred and George have got the gold. Spent a good bit of it, too, by the sounds of it. And I can't get it back from them, and I don't want to. So save your breath, Hermione. I wasn't going to say anything about Fred and George, she said in an injured voice. Ron snorted disbelievingly and threw Hermione, and Hermione threw him a very dirty look. No, I wasn't, she said angrily. As a matter of fact, I was going to ask Harry when he's going to back to Snape and ask for occlumency lessons again. Harry's heart sank. Once they had exhausted the subject of Fred and George's dramatic departure, which admittedly had taken many hours, Ron and Hermione wanted to hear news of Sirius. As Harry had not confided in them the reason he wanted to talk to Sirius in the first place, it had been hard to think of things to tell them. He ended up saying to them truthfully that Sirius wanted Harry to resume his occlumency lessons. He had been regretting this ever since. Hermione would not let the subject drop and kept reverting to it when Harry had least expected it. You can't tell me you've stopped having funny dreams, Hermione said now, because Ron told me last night you were muttering in your sleep again. Harry threw Ron a furious look. Ron had the grace to look ashamed of himself. You're only muttering a bit, he mumbled apologetically, something about just a bit farther. I dreamed I was watching you play Quidditch, Harry lied brutally. I was just trying to get you to stretch out a bit farther to grab the quaffle. Ron's ears went red. Harry felt a vindictive pleasure. He had not, of course, dreamed anything of the sort. Last night, he had once again made the journey along the Department of Mysteries corridor. He had passed through the circular room, then the room full of clicking and dancing light, until he found himself again inside that cavernous room full of shelves on which ranged dusty glass spheres. He hurried straight toward row number 97, turned left and ran along. It had probably been then that he'd spoken aloud just a bit farther, for he could feel his conscious self struggling to wake, and before he had reached the end of the row, he had found himself lying in bed again, gazing up at the canopy of his four-poster. You are trying to block your mind, aren't you? Said Hermione, looking beadily at Harry. You are keeping going on with your occlumency? Of course I am, said Harry, trying to sound as though this question was insulting, but not quite meeting her eye. The truth was that he was so intensely curious about what was hidden in that room full of dusty orbs that he was quite keen for the dreams to continue. The problem was that, with just under a month to go until the exams, and every free moment devoted to studying, his mind seemed saturated with information when he went to bed, so that he found it was difficult to get to sleep at all. When he did, his overwrought brain presented him most nights with stupid dreams about the exams. He also suspected that part of his mind, the part that often spoke in Hermione's voice, now felt guilty on the occasions it strayed down that corridor, ending in the black door, and sought to wake him before he could reach the journey's end. You know, said Ron, whose ears were still flaming red, if Montague doesn't recover before Slytherin plays Hufflepuff, we might be in with a chance of winning the cup. Yeah, I suppose so, said Harry, glad of a chance of a subject, change of a subject. I mean, we've won one, lost one. Slytherin lose to Hufflepuff next Saturday. Yeah, that's right, said Harry, losing track of what he was agreeing to. Cho Chang had walked across the courtyard, determinedly not looking at him. And I think we'll stop there. I hope you liked that, my kitten boo. You're a sweet kitty. I love you so much. Good night, baby girl. I love you.